The subject we've been assigned to consider for the next 90 minutes is entitled Our Best for the Master. I'd like to make just a few introductory comments to sort of set our minds in proper perspective as we enter this subject. Some of you, when I begin this story, will recognize it very clearly. I'm sure you've heard it. Some of you, since you were very small children. But I think it's a good illustration of this precise principle at work in the lives of Christians. There was a young evangelist who stood overlooking the coffin of his recently deceased uncle. His uncle was an incredible student of the Bible. Once at a meeting, a young man by the name of Mel Short asked him what passage he would like read prior to the lesson. Well, the old evangelist said, "Oh, just pick one you like." And without sharing his selection with anyone, Mel read his passage, sat down, watched this old evangelist step to the podium, and preach an extemporaneous sermon from that very passage he just read. This young evangelist uncle was an incredible student of the Bible. His uncle was also a powerful debater, and his particular area of expertise was Mormonism. Once Carl Ketcher's side was talking with the Mormon, and during the course of the conversation, a debate was challenged by one of the sides. It was also decided that each man would choose a partner for the debate. The Mormon declared his partner and then asked Carl who he would choose. Carl chose this young evangelist uncle. The Mormon promptly canceled the debate. He was a powerful debater. But according to his own testimony, this young evangelist recalls looking at his uncle's dead body, and thinking the following, and I'm sure I'm paraphrasing this. A great man has died. Think of all the knowledge that died with him. What an incredible loss for the church. And then the young evangelist realized something. His uncle acquired all of that knowledge through hard work and study. If he did it, so can I. If he did it, so can I. From that day forward, that young evangelist, for the edification of the Lord's body and the glory of his name, endeavored to be a great student and teacher of the Bible. And if you knew who he was, you would agree. The point of the story is this. This young evangelist gave his best for the Master. He had a moment where he thought the church had lost someone great. What are they going to do without this powerful speaker, without this powerful debater? And then he realized. Then he realized that he could have that same knowledge himself. And so he set forth the challenge for himself and gave his best for the Master. My question to you this afternoon is this. What will we do when we're standing over the coffins of men like Marvin Ingle, or Tom Dennis, or Richard Riggins? What will be our thoughts that go through our minds that day? Will we allow our thoughts to stop with, a great man has died and all that knowledge died with him? What a loss for the church. Is that where our thought will stop? Or, like this young evangelist, will we answer God's clarion call to each successive generation of potential leaders in the Lord's church? Will we give Isaiah's answer? Here am I. Send me. Or will we give Jonah's answer? Will we run from God, find a comfortable place in the ship's hull, and fall fast asleep? Are you giving your best for the Master? Will you give your best for the Master? When I was assigned this topic, I was given three different questions to address this afternoon. The first question was, look at different areas of our life. In these different areas, what are some key practical applications to giving our best to the Master? And as this class unfolds, you'll notice that much of it will be very pragmatic, very practical in nature. And I would really appreciate some input from you as well, particularly those among us who are a little bit grayer of head than I am, those of you that have a lot more experience than I do. I would appreciate that greatly, because much of what I have to say, I've tried to base it on Scripture as best I can in my own experience, and my experience is very limited. The second question I was asked, if we are to give our best, should we then limit ourselves to doing only the things we are good at? In other words, should I only exercise my gifts and not worry about anything else? Should I limit myself in such a way? And the final question I was asked, often this phrase has been used to justify requiring that everyone dress to the nines, so to speak, for services. Is this really a part of giving our best to the Master? I'm sure we've all heard that principle applied to our dress at worship services. We need to dress our best because we need to give our best to the Master. And the question is this, is that principle relevant to this topic, as I understand the question that is? So to answer these three questions, we're going to look at four areas. First of all, I want to consider the scriptural precedent for this principle. Where does this idea of giving our best to the Master come from? How is it established within the Scripture? And we'll take a look all the way from Genesis through the New Testament about this. Area number two we'll take a look at is just simply offering our best for the Master. What does that mean? How do we go about that? The third question is, should we only use our gifts? In other words, should I just simply exercise what God has given me and limit it to that? Or should I step outside my comfort level, perhaps, and try something that I may not necessarily be good at, naturally, but I want to serve the Lord? How should we handle things like that? And finally, I want to consider some warnings from the book of Malachi. And those that are familiar with the book of Malachi know that God was very displeased with Israel's offerings. And I want to consider some of the things that are said in the book of Malachi that relate to offerings. Before we begin, is anything, any questions, anything unclear so far that I've said? I'd be happy to clarify anything. Okay. Let's consider some scriptural precedent for this concept. From the beginning, God has demanded quality in the offerings he receives from man. Remember the case in Genesis chapter 4. Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord, while his brother Abel, and notice the words that are used here, brought of the firstborn of his flock and of the fat. Abel gave God his best. This is why Abel's sacrifice was respected and Cain's was not. Recall in Genesis chapter 6 through 8 that in addition to gathering two of every unclean animal in the ark, Noah was to gather how many of every clean animal? Does anybody remember? Seven. Two of every unclean animal and seven of every clean animal. Apparently at some point God had revealed what was clean and what was unclean to the people of this time. Noah knew who those clean animals were, so he gathered them. If you would, turn to the 8th chapter of the book of Genesis. I want you to notice what happens here. In Genesis chapter 8, let's look at verses 20 and 21. Notice how Noah's sacrifice is described. Genesis 8, 20 and 21. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. Now remember, there were seven of every clean animal. And it appears that Noah took that extra animal and offered them in sacrifice to God. Verse 21, and the Lord smelled the soothing aroma. Then the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. Noah took of the clean animals, offers a sacrifice to God. God smells it, he is pleased, and he makes a promise. And what is that promise? I will never destroy the earth with water again. God was pleased with Noah's sacrifice. Noah gave the best of what he had. He offered a clean animal. Then perhaps the best example of someone giving their greatest possession occurs in Genesis chapter 22, and I'm speaking just in Old Testament terms. Genesis 22, you all know the story very well. Abraham was willing to sacrifice his most precious possession, his only son, as an offering to the Lord. Here we have three examples in the Old Testament of men giving their best to God. In the case of Abel, in the case of Noah, and in the case of Abraham, although Abraham didn't offer that sacrifice, he was willing to do so. I want to take care of one more thing, and then we'll open it up for comments. Let's consider what the old law has to say about the quality of offerings as well. The sacrifices of the old law required the very best of what man possessed. Over 36 times, on 36 different occasions, I should say, in the old law, God demands a sacrificial animal to be without blemish. To be without blemish. Perfect. In Leviticus chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, the grain offering was to consist of the finest flour mixed with oil and frankincense. Finest flour mixed with oil and frankincense. In Deuteronomy chapter 14, verses 22 and 23, the children of Israel were to tithe the increase of their grain each year along with their new wine and oil. In other words, what they had from before, what went beyond that, what they had before, was what they were to tithe. They were to give of the best, of the increase of what God had provided. And finally, and I want to turn to this passage and read this, in Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 15 through 18, you'll notice that what God had set aside for himself was not to be used for a common purpose. In other words, those things that God identified, those possessions that the children of Israel had as a result of God's blessings, were not to be used for a common purpose. They were set aside for a very specific purpose. Deuteronomy 12, 15 through 18. However, you may slaughter and eat meat within all your gates, whatever your heart desires, according to the blessing of the Lord your God, which he has given you. The unclean and the clean may eat of it, of the gazelle and the deer alike. Only you shall not eat the blood, you shall pour it out on the earth like water. You may not eat it within your gates, the tithe of your grain, or your new wine, or your oil, of the firstborn of your herd, or your flock, or any of your offerings, which you vow, of your freewill offerings, or of the heave offering of your hand. But you must eat them before the Lord your God in the place which the Lord your God chooses, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant and your female servant, and the Levite who is within your gates, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God in all to which you put your hands. Verse 17 is the key verse. Those things that God had identified and set apart for himself were not to be used for a common purpose. The firstborn of the flock was not to be eaten by the children of Israel in any place but at the tabernacle. That was the only place that it should be eaten. So those things that were to be dedicated to God, the very best, were to be set aside for God and for God alone, and not to be used for any other purpose whatsoever. So as we see, from the beginning God demanded the best in sacrifices, and he continues that message on through the old law as well. He demanded the best from the children of Israel. I'll pause here for a moment. I know there are other examples that you might want to cite from the Old Testament. Are there any comments or questions, things that might be unclear? Yeah, Kevin, go right ahead. Thank you. That's an excellent comment. I hope the recording caught that. If not, I'll just go. You want me to go ahead and repeat those comments? Yeah. Kevin's comment was essentially, to be a sacrifice, it's got to be important to the person who offers it. Otherwise, it's not really a sacrifice. You're not really losing anything. It's got to have some value to the person who's offering it. Otherwise, it's not really a sacrifice at all. Good. Other thoughts that you'd like to add? Oh, Tom, go ahead.
Another principle from the Old Testament is that God asked for first fruits. Mm-hmm. So when you received the increase from the Lord, it was only right to give him the first part rather than waiting for the end and being the benefit. It was good to give it right off.
Thank you. Anything else? Kevin, one more. Go ahead.
I know along the lines of what Tom said, rather than saying how much money will this tract get to the Lord, say how much of the Lord on the
That's exactly right. And that principle is well established by God in the Old Law, is it not? He's given them these things. He's brought them into this land. He's blessed them with increase in their fields. He's given them increase in their flocks. They belong to Him. They are stewards of what God has given. Therefore, we're just simply giving back to God what is His to begin with.
Thank you.
Anything else? All right. Well, when we reach the new covenant, we see a transition occur when it comes to our sacrifices. We no longer offer animals. We no longer offer grain offerings. We have a new sacrifice that we are to offer, and that sacrifice, I think, is best articulated by Romans, the 12th chapter, verse 1. I know you probably know it by heart, but let's go ahead and turn there just to read it. Never hurts to read it and see it one more time in black and white for ourselves. Romans chapter 12, verse 1. We might call this a transition point, if you will. Of course, the transition point occurred many years before Paul actually wrote this, but Paul captures this transition point in this first verse of Romans 12 very well. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Prior to the cross, man's sacrifices consisted of the bodies of animals. So when he says that you are to offer your body as a living sacrifice, we have an important distinction made. The bodies of animals were presented on behalf of the worshiper as an offering to God. But now the body of the worshiper is the offering to God. Something is not standing in our place. Instead, we are doing it ourselves. We are placing our bodies upon the altar and offering them to God. And notice also that he calls this a living sacrifice. Under the Old Law and in the patriarchs, we see the sacrifice slain and killed. But now we have a sacrifice that is living, that is perpetual, if you will. In short, it is the whole Christian life that becomes an offering to God, laying our very lives on His altar, submitting ourselves completely to the will of God, surrendering ourselves and becoming a continuous offering to the Lord. That is giving our best for the Master. Other things you'd like to say about Romans 12 and 1 or anything else prior to this, questions, comments that you might have? Let's consider some ways that our offerings manifest themselves within the new covenant. As I think we all well know, we don't offer animals, but our offerings do come in a variety of different ways than they did previously. In Mark chapter 14, verses 3 through 9, we have a woman who anointed the feet of Jesus with oil whose value was close to a year's wages. Would you consider that an offering to God? Absolutely. She took something of value to herself, as Kevin alluded to earlier, and of value monetarily for that meaning, pours it on the feet of Jesus and anoints him with it. That is an offering. In Luke chapter 21, verses 1 through 4, as Jesus is sitting and observing those who are placing money in the temple treasury, he noticed this widow with two mites What does he have to say about that widow in Luke 21? Given more than even the very rich among them. Because they gave out of their abundance, but she gave out of her poverty. Is that an offering to the Lord? Absolutely. Dedication of our finances, if you will. Acts chapter 4, verses 34 through 37. Does anybody remember what was happening here? Acts 4, 34 through 37. See if you can remember. Acts 4, 34. That's Acts 5, but you're on the right track. Acts 4, 34 through 37. Yeah, very good. Barnabas wasn't the only one. There were several within the early church who had possessions and land, were selling them, and giving the money, laying it at the apostles' feet. There's another example of Christian offering, of a sacrifice given. And in this case, the offering was for other people, was it not? It was for the daily distribution, as we read about later in Acts chapter 6, so that no one among the congregation would have any needs whatsoever. Okay? 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 through 4. This is a beautiful one to me. Let's just go ahead and take the time to read that. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 through 4. Moreover, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. For I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, and beyond their ability, they were freely willing, imploring us with much urgency that we would receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. The churches of Macedonia were contributing to this general fund that Paul was taking back to Jerusalem at this time. And his testimony concerning these Macedonians was this. They're poor people. And they gave till it hurt. They gave till it hurt. Verse 2. The abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. They gave till it hurt. Here's a great example of Christian offering. Not only giving what you're able to give, but giving beyond what you're able to give. Laying it on the altar, giving it to the Lord. Philippians chapter 4, verses 15 through 18. The church of Philippi was, of course, located in Macedonia. And Paul reflects back on the gift that he had received from the church of Philippi. And he calls it a sweet-smelling aroma, an acceptable sacrifice, well-pleasing to God. What they gave him was a sacrifice. It was an offering. And as he attests, it was well-pleasing to God. Remember what is written in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 15. Does anybody remember? Hebrews 13 and 15. Ah, very good. We are to continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to His name. We have several examples that we've looked at so far where people were giving their possessions of their financial resources, contributing to the needs of others. But in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 15, Paul, or the writer of Hebrews, it probably was Paul, makes the point that the praise of our lips, the fruit of our lips, what we have to say, is a sacrifice to God as well. Do you remember in Revelations chapters 5 and 8, how the prayers of the saints are depicted as they come up before the throne of God? Incense, aren't they? They're depicted as incense coming up before the throne of God. Your prayer is an offering to God. It's a sacrifice to God. It is to Him as incense. It smells good to Him. But the greatest offering we have under the new covenant, the greatest example of an offering, is Jesus Christ Himself. And I'll point your attention to the book of Ephesians, chapter 5, verse 2. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 2, Paul has this to say about Christ's sacrifice. And walk in love as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma. Christ's sacrifice was to God a sweet-smelling aroma. It was a valuable thing, and the Lord was pleased with it. So we see, from the beginning, God demanded the very best of what man had to offer. That continues down through the Old Law, and we see under the New Covenant that God demands of us a sacrifice, our own lives, a living sacrifice, as it's called there. And we see clearly displayed throughout all these passages, and I'm sure you could cite many more, how the Christian life, in its summation, is a continual offering to God, giving our best for the Master. Is there anything else that you'd like to add? Any questions? I'd love to hear more information. Anything? I'm going to warn you, I've only prepared about an hour to an hour and 15 minutes worth of material, so if you guys don't start commenting, we're going to run a little short here. I hope that you all would make some comments, and perhaps this next section is really where the comments will begin to flow. I realize sometimes that I tend to lecture rather than encouraging comments, and my apologies for that. Let's talk about offering our best to the Master. And I want to just take a moment. Go ahead, Tom. Yeah.
I was thinking about the sacrifice being the best. The sacrifice is a type of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's probably the most important aspect of it being the best, that God would give his best for us.
Thank you. Yeah.
And it's important to remember that, because some people think that they'll go to heaven by giving God the best. And It isn't about, you know, the best we can do is not good enough. It doesn't atone for our sin. But if we are in Christ, we have the best.
Mm-hmm.
And He makes us the best. So it's good to keep that in mind if we talk about being the best. Christ is really the best. He's, he said about His Father, there's only one good.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all pointing us towards Christ, who is heaven's best. As opposed to saying, you'll do your best. There's a lot of people think that, and don't think you need it. You're doing your best.
Thank you. Imagine where we'd be if God had withheld His best from us. Imagine where we'd be if God withheld His best from us. We have no excuse to withhold our best from God. He's left us no wiggle room, so to speak, no room to argue. He's given us His best. We therefore must give Him our best. Thank you. Anything else? All right. Let's talk about offering our best to the Master. I want to just back up for a moment and think in very broad terms. We touched on, when we talked about the Old Law, that the offering itself was an item that was given by God. It was a blessing from God. It was something that was possessed by the worshiper, but it was set aside by the worshiper for a specific purpose. For a specific purpose. For a moment, I'd like for you to think about what purposes did the offering serve under the Old Law? What purposes did they serve? Okay? Very good. So they were for the benefit of other people, right? The offerings of the children of Israel benefited others, in specific, the Levites. Without that, the Levites had no inheritance. To withhold their offerings meant to withhold the Levites' inheritance. Okay? Benefited the Levites. Good. What else? What other purpose did the sacrifices serve? Okay, offering for sin. Restitution for sinful activity, right? Okay, good. What else? expression of gratitude. Thankfulness for what God had given them. Good. What else? Okay. Obedience. All right. Anything else? Okay. What about the vow of the Nazarite? What are the sacrifices in connection with that? What did that perform? What was the Nazarite? Someone who had taken a vow, right? Exactly. They had dedicated themselves to God. Sacrifices, one of the purposes that they served was they demonstrated a dedication to the Lord, which I think would fall in with the humility, the idea of obedience, that I've dedicated myself to God, to Jehovah. So really, when we talk about sacrifices and offerings, they really fall into four purposes. We have the restitution for sinful activity. In other words, you've got to make some sort of payment. And of course, in Christianity, that payment's been made, but what's required in order for us to be forgiven for our sinful activity once we become a member of the Lord's body? We have to confess, right? Which means we have to express that in prayer, which is to God an offering. We've got to make use of those means that He has made available to us. Christian offerings benefit others, do they not? That's what we see in the early church. I cited three or four examples where generosity of Christians benefited other Christians. They helped others along, which parallels the old law as well. Christian offerings express gratitude. When you go before God in prayer and you thank Him for what He's given you, that is a very special thing to God. How many times in the New Testament does it tell us to be thankful? That seems so simple, but it's so important that we be thankful for what God has given us. Expressing gratitude, and finally a dedication to God. Declaring that we want to be a Christian, we want to be aligned with God. I think what we see under the old law parallels what we have under the new law as well. And perhaps there might be some things that you'd like to suggest that would be additional purposes for sacrifices or offerings, if you will. Other thoughts that you have. What's the purpose that our offerings serve? Thoughts that you might have. What purpose? Yeah. I think I'd put that under dedication to God. But yeah, I think to me that would fall under that blanket, but it may not to everybody. Yeah. Reminding ourselves who we belong to, what we need to do as a result of what He's given to us. Other thoughts? Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Tom?
When Paul was talking to Corinthians 9 and 12, he gives some good reasons here. He says that work for this administration, this service, not only supplies the want of the saints, but is abundant also by many kinds given to us. To help others with this, in this case, to help the needy, and it causes more thanksgiving.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point, because when we look at these four purposes, when you look at the old law, an offering could fit more than one of these purposes. And under the new law, that would be true as well. That not only is it helping others, but it would be an expression of gratitude to God for what's been done. You know, there's a an interesting thought has occurred to me recently. You know, sometimes we have a tendency to be fiercely independent. And when we need help, sometimes we don't want to ask for help because we just don't want to bother people. But it's occurred to me that when people extend an offering for help, if I don't accept that, then I'm denying them the opportunity to do this very thing, am I not? That doesn't mean I take advantage of my brethren. It doesn't mean I run roughshod over them. But precisely what Tom's talking about can result from that. They can give an offering to God, and then because of them, I can lift my praise and thanksgiving to Him for having such wonderful brethren. So here we have essentially one offering that results in two different purposes being fulfilled. That's a great point, Tom. Thank you. That's a wonderful thing to keep in mind. Anything else? Yeah,
for sure.
Very good. Anything else to contribute? Okay, let's do a little brainstorming here. What offerings does God expect from everyone? And by this, what are the expectations that God has for all of His people? I guess we might call these general offerings. And I've already touched on a lot of them through the passages, but I want to pick some categories here to keep in mind. What are some offerings that everyone, if they're a Christian, is required to give to God? Their lives, right? Their very lives. No one gets out of that one if they're a Christian. That's a requirement for everyone. Okay? What else? Most everyone can pray. That's good.
Yeah, sure.
Good.
Yeah.
What else? Visit the fatherless and the widows. Offerings that are expected from everyone. We looked at financial resources, right? That's a pretty obvious one. Prayer's been mentioned. We talked about in Revelation 5 and 8, how that's incense rising before the throne of God. To do good and to share. That's Hebrews chapter 13, verse 16. To do good and to share. Do good and to share. Several of the things you mentioned would fall under that umbrella, would they not? Visiting the fatherless and the widows. Singing. Making melody in our hearts to the Lord. Now, despite what some people in the world may think, anyone who can speak can sing. It doesn't really matter how it sounds to our ears. All that matters is what's happening in our hearts. Our mind. And isn't that what Romans chapter 12, verse 2 talks about? Not being conformed to this world, but being transformed by the renewing of our mind. Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 through 15 talks about setting our mind on things above. For we have died and our life is hidden with Christ. Casting out the things of this world and putting inside of ourselves the things that are from God. Here's a big one. Time. God expects us to offer our time. I think that's probably one that we all struggle with. How much time is enough? Is there enough time? Can God ever be satisfied with the amount of time we can offer to Him? Ephesians 5, verses 15 and 16, redeeming the time for the days are evil. Well, it doesn't really talk about it as an offering. I think that it is applicable, though. God expects our time. How are we using our time? Are we using it for Him? Or are we using it for ourselves? Anything else in connection with this? Other thoughts? What does He expect from everyone? Okay. The question that this now begs from us, and I think this is really the heart of my assignment, at least so far as I understood the questions that Joshua asked me. The question I think that results is, are there individualized offerings that we're expected to give? In other words, are there offerings that I have to give that you don't have to give just based on what we possess, the gifts that we have? And I think the answer to that question is yes. We have these general offerings that I think we're all expected to give, but I think there are things that are specific to each one of us that we have to offer to the Lord as well. We're talking about our personal gifts, the natural abilities and talents that God has given each one of us to use in the service of one another and in the service of Him. We all have them. Some of us have more than others. But the important point, as Richard cited, is that we are all fruitful in using these gifts, putting these gifts to work. And to me, this strikes at the heart of my assignment. God expects all this from everyone. We're talking about offering our best. It also talks about what we have to give as individuals. What do I have that somebody else does not? How do I go about giving that? I think the first question we have to answer is, how do we determine our gifts? What are the gifts God has given me? What are the talents and abilities He has invested in me for use in the church? Let's open this up for a moment. How do you figure out what you're good at? What has God given you that is a talent and ability that you can put to work? How do you determine that? Okay, trial and error. Okay, feedback from others. Is this a hard thing to do? What could happen if we don't handle this with the proper attitude? Where can this type of question lead us if we're not careful? It can lead us to pride, can't it? If we're not careful, this type of question can lead us to pride. I do think there is a way that it can be handled, though, properly, that will not lead us to pride. And I think it begins with this realization, and I think it's been pointed out many times already. We've not come to these gifts and these talents and these abilities by anything we've done. We've done nothing to earn what God has given us. And what He has invested in you and I has not come to me because I'm anything special. I am a tool in His hands. And that's all I am. So, it's important for us to begin with that mindset, remembering that we're just earthen vessels, right? We're earthen vessels. God's invested these things in each one of us. So how do you go about determining what your gifts are? Well, I think we've got to begin with the question, what do I do well? What do I do well? And the second question we've got to ask ourselves, is there a righteous use for this or these talents? There are things that I can do very well that I should not do because they're unrighteous. I think of some people who are great liars, terrific liars. You'd never know that they were lying to you. But there's no righteous use for that, is there? So it's not just simply a matter of, of determining what do I do well, it's also a matter of determining, is there a righteous use for this? And then the next step, I think, has to be, are there scriptural opportunities to put these talents to work? And notice how I've worded that, scriptural opportunities. Do I have scriptural precedent to exercise this gift? Is there a righteous use for it? Is there scriptural precedent for it? And the final question I think we've got to answer is, how will I excel and grow in the use of this gift? The thing we've got to keep in mind is, who are we doing this for? Who are we seeking to grow for? Who are we seeking to excel for? For God, number one, and for who else? For the brethren. For the church. So that the church can be edified. When that young evangelist was standing over the coffin of his grandfather, I know he was not thinking of becoming a great scholar for his own good. He was thinking of serving the church. He was thinking of putting what God had given him to work for the good of others and the glory of his name. But as Richard rightly points out, we've got to bear fruit. We've got to excel. We've got to grow. Not for our own good, but for the good of others. And if we keep this selfless attitude in mind, if we keep ourselves grounded by remembering, I've not come to this by myself. God has invested this in me. If we keep that at the forefront of our minds, that we're really nothing special. If we seek it for the right reasons, I believe that we can be an effective tool in the hands of God. But we've got to keep the right mindset. Other comments that you have, and I'd really appreciate some. Tom, go ahead.
The following verses in Romans 12 are good.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Don't be conformed to the world in verse 2. Mm-hmm. Because if you're thinking worldly terms, this doesn't interest you at all.
Mm-hmm.
You're not really unless you're pride and glory. But if we're spiritually minded, then we think we're doing the church, and then the third verse is good for our humility, which is goes right along to speaking of the first investment.
Mm-hmm.
So think more highly, think soberly, lift yourself honestly, and look to what God gave you, and remember that you're a member of the body, and then he has a list of starting verse 2. Now, having been just written and reporting from grace and given to us, whether prophecy, whether prophecy, according to the portion of faith, or of ministry, let us wait on you. He that speaks with contrition, he that exhorts with exhortation, he that gives, let him do it with simplicity, he that rules with diligence, he that shows mercy with cheerfulness.
Other thoughts? Thomas?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, part of the personally,
that's true. That's true. It takes one to know one, as the old saying goes, right? Good. Other thoughts? Yeah, Richard, go ahead. Uh-huh.
How would you define when a gift is being used in service of the Lord? When it brings that line, serving the Lord and serving yourself? Because in Genesis, the second chapter, Adam and Eve were put in the garden to sin and keep it. The way I view that, that was part of the service of the Lord. Because of Ecclesiastes, Solomon spent a fair amount of time dealing with what man does and how he does it. And in the second chapter, he speaks a lot about the purpose of man to toil, labor under the sun, and provide for his family. That is the purpose of man.
So your question is, how do you draw the distinction between what is self-serving and what is serving God?
Right.
Go ahead. Okay.
I guess that's one of the few things in my life that wrong there is all the translations of the official law of the
Okay. I would agree with that. I think the scriptures are a guide in this. Number one, is it fulfilling a purpose that God has ordained? And number two, what's our attitude? Is our attitude to glorify ourselves, or is our attitude to serve others and glorify Him? I don't know. Maybe there are some situations we could think of that such a simple definition might not work, but I think just in general, that simple definition is effective enough for me. Other thoughts you might have? Did you have a thought about that at all?
Well, it was some time ago, I used to think that the only way that I can really serve the Lord, and give my all to Him, is to say, need an angel to do that. Mm-hmm. To spend my entire life preaching the gospel. But considering, Adam, his job for the Lord, but mm-hmm. I think that you can serve the Lord in your career for as long as it is with the right attitude, mm-hmm. providing for the family, mm-hmm. and using it up for the Lord in work.
Absolutely.
Which goes along with Paul's teaching in practical areas. The wives submit to their husbands as unto the Lord,
mm-hmm.
and the worker works for his master as unto the Lord. And that is serving God, and which enables us to do our best. If we look at it as I'm doing God instead of doing for you, then that causes us to do it.
Other contributions. John, go ahead. Absolutely. And when we look at the jobs of elders and evangelists in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 through 16, they're there to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for the edification of the body. A good elder, a good evangelist who's working with a congregation can help a young person by pointing out that talent they may not know exists and help them put it to work. Great point. Thank you. Anything else? Okay. All right, so here's the question. We've talked about our offerings to God. We've talked about offering our gifts to Him. And I think we would all agree that based on scriptural precedent, we should give our best to the Master. Yes. Yeah, Grant, go ahead. Yeah, in fact, that'll be the next thing we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. Does this principle apply to our dress? Well, I'm going to give you an answer. It may not be an answer that you're looking for. What I've striven to do today is to establish that this principle of our best for the Master relates to the quality of our offerings to God. That's the precedent that's established in the Old Law and is carried through the New. The question I think we've got to answer is, does my attire, how I'm dressed, qualify as an offering to God? The point behind the application of this principle is that it is an offering to God. That how I dress is a way that I can offer something to God. I would agree with that to the extent that the New Testament legislates concerning our dress. The New Testament guidelines for dress are pretty clear. It must be modest. It must fall within conservative, well-established cultural norms. And if these expectations are met, I believe it's fitting for a worship service. Now, taking it beyond that and establishing a dress code, I don't believe I can do. In other words, I would not say if someone's not dressed in a suit on Sunday morning, that their offering is illegitimate. I could not say that. Now, someone else may feel very strongly about that, and I respect that as well. I believe that this comes down to the principle that's discussed in Romans chapter 14. And Romans chapter 14, as you know, is dealing with the conscience. Whether or not to apply this principle and how far to apply it, I believe, falls into the area of one's conscience. If, brethren, for conscience's sake, apply this principle to dress, then we who do not must honor their conviction and avoid the creation of stumbling blocks. If you don't agree with the fact that they believe that a suit should be worn on Sunday morning, then don't go out of your way to trip them up. You've got to respect and honor their position. That is essential. In return, those brethren who believe that such a strict adherence to clothing guidelines, who choose to apply this the principle, must not judge or condemn those who do not. That's the lesson in Romans 14. As Paul says, both parties should be fully persuaded, they should act in faith, and Romans 14:19, pursue the things which make for peace, and the things by which one may edify another. That's the key. Pursue things that make for peace, and things that lead to edification. So my answer to this question is, yes it does, but only to a point. Only to the point that the New Testament legislates. Anything beyond that, I leave to your own conscience. If you believe that a suit is required for Sunday morning, that's your conviction. I respect that. I honor that. I only caution you not to judge or condemn those who do not. And in return, those who do not, be sure that you honor and respect those who do. Pursue peace. Pursue things that make for edification. Any questions or comments? A lot of you have dealt with this subject far more extensively than I have just now. That's my simple answer. You may view it as a cop-out, but I think it's scripturally sound. Anything? I'd be happy to hear any discussion. Either everybody agrees or disagrees. Or that, or nobody wants to say. Exactly right. My fear is that people don't respect one another, don't love one another, and things are done specifically to attack the other person's position, and that's not the spirit of Christ at all. That's my concern. Pursuing things that make for peace and edification. Yeah, Tom, go ahead.
One of the problems with clothing is that we often do not see ourselves as other people. Mm-hmm. I know that there's young women, for example, that don't realize how they look to men.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they wear the fashion of the day, provocative.
Mm-hmm.
They can probably not be aware. They have no idea. We should learn from that and realize that, you know, people do notice what we wear.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just say, well, you're not supposed to notice what I wear.
Mm-hmm.
You should keep that in mind when you do. Mm-hmm. And realize that what you do, what you wear, does say, whether you want it to or not. Even though you don't intend to, I don't mean anything by that. Well, other people take things.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything else?
How
thank you for that. Other thoughts in connection with this? All right. Well, just in summation, when it comes down to offering our best for the Master, essentially what that means is we take the very best of what God has distributed to each of us and offer it up in service to Him. He has general offerings which He expects from each of us, along with individually specific offerings. Our duty is to determine what those individual offerings are, and put them to work. Put them to work. Now, the question that Grant asked is this question of, should a Christian offering be limited to the gifted in a particular area? In other words, if I don't have a gift, but I want to serve God in some way that goes beyond how I'm gifted, can I do that? Of course, the answer is yes. I believe so. For a moment, let's just pretend that we're speaking about the gift of public teaching. Just for clarity's sake, so we're all following what's being said here. I believe that there's a difference between a gifted public teacher and an effective public teacher. Let me tell you what I mean by that. A gifted public teacher is one who possesses the natural ability to teach publicly. This is one of their gifts from God. But an effective public teacher is one who lacks the natural ability to teach publicly, but through desire, dedication, perseverance, and steady growth becomes effective with time. I believe there are people that are naturally gifted publicly, and I think that there are people who, with hard work and patience, can become effective publicly. I think we can see a difference when we compare Paul and Apollos. In Acts chapter 18, verse 24, Apollos is called an eloquent man. He had a gift for speaking publicly. But Paul, by his own admission in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, did not have that same gift. And I, brethren, when I came to you, did not come with excellence of speech or of wisdom, declaring to you the testimony of God. For I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. 2 Corinthians 10 and 10 helps clear that up as well. Paul was not gifted publicly. He was not mighty with words, so to speak. But he was an effective public teacher. While he did not have the same level of eloquence as a man like Apollos, it is clear that Paul was able to teach effectively in a public venue. Of course, in the case of the gifted, I believe that they have a responsibility before God to exercise that gift and to grow in its execution, which is the point of Matthew chapter 25, the parable of the talents. You're to put your gift to work, and you are to grow in it. But when it comes to someone who's not gifted but wants to perform this work, I believe his primary responsibility lies in fulfilling his gifts. And then if he wants to do something else and sets his mind to it, then God be praised for what is accomplished. So, to answer this question, I would say no. Christian offerings should not be simply limited to those who have the gift to offer it. I would say no to that. I believe that one can become effective in areas that lie beyond our natural gifts. And I think we see examples among us. So the question becomes, and these are the passages I just listed there, how do we become effective? If I don't have a gift in an area, how can I become effective? Or do you even think it's possible? Do you even agree with what I just said? Maybe you don't. We'll just open that up for discussion.
First thing I thought of was that there are those that are gifted that are not gifted.
That's true.
And that's why Paul would tell Timothy to stir up the gift.
Very good.
Well,
I want
to say, fine.
Yeah. And that the failure there is the failure that Jesus warns against in the parable of the talents. Not taking what God's given you and putting it to work. Not growing in it. Not bringing about an increase with what he's given. There's the failure. The question is, if you don't have a gift and you want to serve God in a capacity in which you're not gifted, then how do you become effective in that? And I do believe it is possible, and I think we see examples among us. Oftentimes we take the examples of people who don't speak to be effective as our examples against this principle. The failure is not in putting someone up there who's not gifted. The failure is they're not working to become effective. There's the failure. They're not trying to become better. They're not trying to grow in that. I've sat in classes where it was obvious that it was going nowhere. Now is that the fault of the person standing up there because they haven't put in the time and the preparation that it takes to teach the class. They haven't grown. That doesn't mean that we should only put the best among us up there. It means that we all need to grow. If we're going to take a responsibility on, we've got to seek, if we're not gifted, to become effective. There's the responsibility. So, how do we become effective? If we don't have the gift, how do we become effective? Well, I think we first must identify whether the desire or interest we possess is self-serving or selfless. It goes back to that whole thing we were talking about before. Do I want to be standing up at that pulpit teaching because I want to have the spotlight on me? Or do I want to be up there teaching because I want to serve the body and bring glory to God's name? So if I'm not gifted there, what's my motivation for getting up there? Do I want to draw attention to myself, or do I want to serve the Lord? I think the next thing you have to do is if you've identified that your desire is selfless, then you need to go talk with your elders or the evangelist who has oversight of your congregation and say, you know, I'm not necessarily gifted in this, but I'd like to try this. I'd like to do this. Can you help me? Can you help me reach this goal? And that's what they're there for. They're there to help equip you. So you need to lean upon them and let them help you through that process. I also think that you've got to keep in mind that you're going to experience failure. And that applies both to the gifted and the one who's seeking to be effective. Failure is an inevitability. You're going to fail. You're going to fall flat on your face. The question is not whether or not you will fail. The question is, how are you going to recover from that failure? Are you going to seek to grow from it, or are you going to allow it to impede your progress? And then I think, and this may be the step that many people who seek to become effective miss, is, are you preparing yourself for this opportunity? If you're not gifted in this area, you're going to have to work much harder than the person who is gifted. You're going to have to put in time that they will not have to put in. You're going to have to do things that they don't have to do. It may require you standing down in your basement with your sermon out in front of you, practicing it two or three times just to get your delivery. Not because it's a performance, but because it's a matter of effectively communicating an idea to an audience. You may have to do things that the normally gifted person does not have to do. You've got to put in work. You've got to prepare. You've got to go the extra mile to go from being an ungifted person to an effective person. And this is where I think brethren fail if they're not gifted. They haven't put in the work and the time. As one brother among us says, and I've heard him say it on many occasions, hard preparation makes for easy listening, and easy preparation makes for hard listening. And it's true. It's true. It's miserable sitting through a class or a sermon that someone has obviously not taken the time to prepare. I would much rather listen to an ungifted speaker, if I can use that adjective, who's taken the time to prepare, who is thoroughly ready to go. His presentation may not be perfect, but it's obvious based on what he is presenting that he has taken the time, that he is concerned about you and wants what's best for you. I'd rather listen to him than listen to someone who is gifted but hasn't put in the time. I think we can all think of examples of brethren like that. I think if you're trying to become effective, you've got to find someone who you trust who will give you constructive criticism. That may be your wife, that may be your best friend, that may be the elder evangelist. But you've got to be willing to accept constructive criticism, and sometimes it doesn't feel very pleasant, does it? That's the only way to grow, is to hear what other people have to say and allow it to shape you. Finally, I think you've got to spend time reflecting back on that experience. Think about it. Think back on that experience and identify one or two things that you could have done better, and then fix them the next time. In other words, you're not just getting up there and taking the shotgun approach and hoping something lands. You're taking a measured approach that's going to help you grow over a long period of time. It's going to take work. It's going to take effort. But if you want to do it, if your desire is to serve the Lord and serve the church, you can become effective. I believe that, and I've seen examples of it. I think one of the finest teachers of the Bible that I know is perhaps the most ungifted man publicly that I can think of in my mind. But I love to hear him give a sermon. I'd love to hear him teach class. Because he's meditated on the Word of God. He's put in the time. He's put in the preparation. And it's wonderful to hear him. He's effective. But he's paid the price. He's paid the price, and I think it's a wonderful thing. Are there any questions or comments, additions you have? Kevin, go right ahead. That's right. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for that. Very good. Other thoughts you have? I think we probably can all think of good examples of men who we've seen this happen to. It all depends on what you're willing to give up in order to accomplish this. And as Kevin rightly points out, and I appreciate his point, relying on the Lord, leaning upon Him. Any other thoughts? Yeah, Kevin? Go ahead. Follow up. Thank you for that. Anything else? Yeah. Very good. That leads right into what looks like it's going to be my final point. I've listed all those out, and I forgot to do that. I'm sorry, guys, but I'm going to have to wrap this up. This segues perfectly into my final point for this afternoon. Yeah. Which is, what are you doing to grow? That's the onus that's on both the man who is gifted and both the one who is seeking to become effective within the kingdom of God. And I use the word effective simply to refer to those who don't have a natural gift. Obviously, even gifted people need to be effective in what they're doing. The question everyone must answer is, what are you doing to grow? I used to think that public participation was how I grew spiritually. I used to think that. What I found that public participation is the result of how I'm growing privately. In other words, if I'm growing privately, then my public participation is simply a fruit of what's taking place in private. It's our effort behind closed doors, not open pulpits, that stimulates our spiritual growth. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, brothers. It's our growth behind closed doors, not open pulpits, that stimulates our spiritual growth. One brother among us offers a good reminder, and I've heard this many times in my life as well. The quality public prayer is the result of consistent private prayer. Quality public prayer is the result of consistent private prayer. That's so true. I used to hear that and think, well, what does he mean by that? And as I've gotten older, I understand exactly what he means by that. If I'm growing privately, what happens publicly will be reflected. Effective public communication. Effective public communication takes a great deal of preparation. It's not a performance. But effective public communication requires meditation. It requires private practice. It requires carefully choosing your words, carefully choosing your scriptures, thinking about what you're going to say, and measuring what you have to say. It's a reflection of your private spiritual growth. If you're not putting the time in your office, in your study, in your bedroom, in your living room, wherever it might be, if you're not putting in your time there, then whatever you do out here, whether it be up here at the pulpit, or whether it be out here in the vestibule, whatever it is, if you're not putting in that private time, what happens out here will not be as effective. You've got to grow. You're the only one that can do that. And the only place you can do that is in private, on your own. Now, am I saying that the public process is not part of growing? No, it is. It is a part. But the biggest part, I think, happens in private. This is where you're going to give your best for the Master. It's staying up that extra hour to tweak that sermon just a little bit more. It's getting up an extra 30 minutes early to make sure you spend some time with the Lord in prayer. It's going out of your way to think about ways that you can help someone in the congregation who's struggling. What happens when people aren't looking? That helps determine how you act when you're out in public. So, if you're not growing spiritually privately, then you're not going to grow publicly either. So I encourage you, as you strive to give your best for the Master, diligently apply yourself to this. Because the results will show up. They will be seen. Are there any final comments or questions, thoughts that you might have? I really hope to get to Malachi, but it looks like we're going to run out of time. I'm glad we did, though, because I thought I appreciated your contributions a great deal. Anything else? Well, I believe you have a 15-minute break. Thank you all.